Health and Human Services Budget Division will come to order. I think we're going to have to start with my bills because Senator Torres Ray is running late.
Why?
My offer's too up.
Well, it's not like you can go home.
It's rationing again, but it's really effective.
Okay, just a few pages.
We'll begin this morning with Senate File 727, Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a bill that deals with an appropriation for Advocating Change Together. And they would like to transfer their existing appropriation from the Council on Developmental Disabilities in the Department of Administration to the Department of Human Services. And they believe that having it in the Department of Human Services, they also might be able to leverage some federal funding against their grant. And why don't we hear from them about it, and then we can take any questions that we might have.
Welcome to the committee. If you would begin by introducing and identifying yourself.
Oh, me. I'm sorry. I'm a little nervous.
Don't be nervous.
I'm Katie McDermott. I'm also on the Act Board with Rick Cardenas. Should I read it now? Or?
Yes.
Okay. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Katie McDermott of the SAM Leadership Council, and I member of the Ag Board. I have been participating in the SAM network for over 1.5 years. In the time, I have grown confidence and more positive attitude about myself and other self-advocates around me. I have had a chance to talk about stopping the R word with our office taking video, and to make more decisions about my life because of SAM and self-advocacy. The bill that Senator Berglund is helping us with will get the SAM Metro started and make it more possible for others all over the state to gain new confidence like I think I have. Thank you for letting me speak.
Ms. McDermott, you are a good advocate.
Oh, thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Years ago, we, with the help through the DD Council, established a self-advocate team, which is a statewide network, which has been functioning for over 2.5 years. We gained some appropriations through the Department of Administration, and again went through the DD Council, and allowed us to really expand the opportunities that we had. And some of the programmatic part of the Self Advocates Minnesota, it helps us to bring the civil and human rights to individuals, gain an understanding of their civil rights. We think helps them to understand their being taken advantage of, whether their civil or human rights may be breached. That is part of the programmatic ending of the self-advocate Minnesota. So the transfer that we have, again, would gain us, we believe, some federal funds to Department of Human Rights, Health and Human Services. And I just happened to notice that a little rain
2005 that of all of the states, Minnesota is way down at the bottom receiving of federal funds. For every dollar Minnesota puts into in taxes, they receive 72 cents back. And so I just want to help you to get a little more of the federal fund back here in Minnesota, at least a little closer to that equal rate. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Senator Berglund.
I do have a technical amendment. It's an A1 amendment. Okay. Just changes a couple of words here and there.
I believe the A1 amendment is in your, it's in our packets.
I move adoption of the amendment.
On Senator Berglund's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Senator Berglund.
So, Madam Chair, I actually believe this bill could go on its own, just in case we get lucky and the House might do the same. Otherwise, if they don't, we can send it out and include it in the omnibus bill. So I would move that Senate File 727, as amended, be recommended to pass.
On Senator Berglund's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. I almost said, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, would you like to continue with Senate File 694?
Yes.
Okay.
And I have an amendment for this bill also. I think it is an A1 amendment as well.
That A1 amendment is being distributed. Senator Berglund, do you want to offer explanation on the A1 as it's being passed out?
The purpose of the amendment is to allow the appropriation to be available until expended. We believe that if this bill becomes law, that it will not be possible for the program to spend the appropriation. They should have had this biennium before the end of June 30th, and so it would just allow them to carry it over.
Any questions from members on the A1 amendment? Senator Berglund moves adoption of the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Senator Berglund on the Senate File 694.
So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, 2 years ago we had... We were trying to get an increase in an appropriation for programs designed to help women and their children that were affected by prenatal alcohol and drugs. And so the Senate went into conference committee with this additional appropriation. And in the course of the conference committee, our target kept getting reduced. And at one point in time, the House had this idea that we could take money from the program that already exists to start the new program. And we never thought that that would work out so well. And in fact, the actual rider didn't take the money from this program. It took it from the entire Children's Services appropriation. This program, in the meantime, within the department, got transferred from Children's Services over to the Chemical Dependency Unit. And so there have been no one bidding for to start a new program. And in the meantime, the existing program is teetering on the edge of collapse because it doesn't have the original appropriation that it was given. And so the purpose of this bill is just to clarify and a allow that money to be released back to the original program.
Senator Berglund, do you have, it looks like you have a testifier with you today. Dr. Dienerd, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
You may proceed.
Well, good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you very much, and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here today to talk about a program with which I've been involved since 1991, I think. In 1991, the Department of Human Services issued an RFP, a request for proposal, for programs, intervention programs that would work with mothers identified during pregnancy or shortly thereafter as substance users. And the thrust was to use community resources. At that time, the thrust was to use community resources to address the chemical mental health issues and to use the intervention to improve the parenting skills of the mothers. Too many of the mothers were losing their children to child protection, being put in foster care, et cetera. So two colleagues of mine at the university, by the way, I'm Amos Dienerd, and I'm at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Pediatrics. Two colleagues of mine, Drs. Byron Eglund and Robert Tenbensel, and I submitted a proposal back in 1991 in response to the RFP in which we proposed using an intervention model called STEEP, Steps Towards Enjoyable Effective Parenting, that Byron Eglund and Marty Erickson had developed in the mid-'80s at the university. And we were funded in 1991, and we've had continuous funding since then. Working with mothers who are identified during pregnancy or shortly thereafter delivery as substance users. And and the thrust of STEEP is that the mothers 1 week are in a group session where they come with their children, food is served, the kids and the mothers are together for a period of time, then the children go off with a child care worker, the mothers are together with the facilitators, and they have a range of topics that they can talk about, and my colleague Brenda Evans-Gagaki, who's behind me, will give you a brief overview when I'm finished as to the structure of those sessions. On the alternate weeks, the facilitators go either to the homes or meet the mothers in the park or at a restaurant, wherever it's the mothers feel comfortable, to talk one-on-one about child-rearing problems. And part of the STEEP strategy is to do videotaping of mothers and children. It's a seeing is believing, a videotaping strategy, where mothers are videotaped interacting with their children. And then those videotapes are reviewed with the mothers so that they can get an idea of where they're being very sensitive to the child's cues, where they're being very insensitive to the child's cues. And they work to improve their sensitivity, if you will, with repeated videotapings will allow them to see the progress they're making at being more attentive to their children. About 4 years ago or 5 years ago now, when I thought that even though we had funding for another year because of the financial status of the state, we were going to lose that funding, I came over to testify about the value of the program. And at that time, Representative Abler challenged me to show him the kinds of outcomes we were having. I had made the statement that one of the things that if you really wanted to save the state money, you would try to clone the program and put the program around the state, not just leave it in Minneapolis. So I went back to the staff and said, okay, we've got to take a look at some of our outcomes. So we made a list of the things that we thought would make good outcomes. And then we looked at the files to see whether the mothers were meeting the expectations or not. And lo and behold, we were extraordinarily pleased to see that the mothers were doing quite well against a set of criteria that we established without any sense of how they were doing, you know, looking at it critically. So I think we can say that based on our experiences, the moms themselves, having been in the program, the kids come in anywhere starting as early as at the mothers may join the program before they deliver, and we keep the kids in until they're 3 years of age. And during that time, the mothers are shown to be themselves much less involved in the criminal justice system. We work very hard. If they come in pregnant, we make sure that they get good prenatal care. If they have just had a child, we make sure that all the mothers get good prenatal care. All of our mothers get postpartum care. And for those who've delivered, we work really hard to encourage good spacing of next pregnancy to a time when they're really emotionally, physically, educationally, financially able to take on another child. And we've had good success there, too. There's an increase in sobriety. We can say that all the kids are getting well child care. Every child is up to date on immunizations. Postpartum care, I've already touched on. There's stability around daycare. There's more stability around housing. Mothers are doing a much better job of planning for their children. Mothers are doing a better job of getting themselves educated, finding jobs, et cetera. And many of the there's much more returning of their children to them for their care rather than losing them to child protection. So I think overall the program is doing what we had set out to do in 1991. It's always a tricky business keeping funding going from year to year. And our hope 2 years ago when the money that Senator Berglund referred to was first proposed, the goal was to not only stabilize our program, but try as best we could to try to clone it elsewhere in the state. And one of the areas that we had zeroed in on was Senator Lurie's area up in the three counties which he represents. And that's still a goal. And if we can get the funding and our base funding can be retained, hopefully we're going to be able to go down the path that we started 2 years ago when we came before this group. Anyone have any questions before Ms. Gaganki gets before the microphone to give a couple of stories of our successes? She's in charge of the facilitators and herself is a facilitator, so she's got firsthand experience with the moms we've been working with.
Thank you, Mr. Dinert. Any questions from the committee? Okay. You have another testifier?
Yes.
Please come forward. Welcome to the committee.
Thank
and if you,
you
would
Thank
identify
you.
Yourself for the record.
Good morning. My name is Brenda Evans Gekange. And I just wanted to just kind of just touch bases a little bit on what Dr. Dinert had mentioned about our program. A Circle of Women is a program for parenting women with children under the age of 2 years of age, and they have a history of substance abuse. Our program is based on the belief that moms are worthy of support and it's never too late to be a good parent to your child. A Circle of Women is a safe place for women to explore how drugs and alcohol has affected their lives as well as the lives of their children. The women that come to our program are struggling with not only the drug addiction but a mental health diagnosis as well. And this has caused them to make some really bad choices for themselves as well as for their children. Most of the women that contact our program for services are involved in child protection, and they need support in improving their parenting skills. Our program has been very positive for a lot of these moms because the majority of them, I'm sorry, this program has been a very positive part of the women's lives because the majority of them are able to have their children returned to them from foster care. We also have some women that have come to us involved in the criminal justice system. And just being a part of our program, I've seen this firsthand with a particular mother that I was working with who came to us that actually had, like, federal charges against her around some drug activity or whatever. And what happened with her was she came and said, I need a letter stating that I'm actually involved in your program and what it is that I'm doing, because she really was trying to turn her life around, had gotten into college and everything, but she still had these charges, and like I said, federal charges, so against her. And I just wrote a letter stating, because she did come to our parenting groups every week, and wrote a letter to the judge just basically stating that, you know, she's here every week, she participates in our program. And I actually went to court with her, and what I found out was the judge actually gave her 5 years probation based on just her being a part. I mean, all he had to go on was the letter that I sent him, as well as a brochure that he read briefly before court, and to say this sounds like a very good program to this mom, that she really needed to stay focused on her goals, and that he would give her these 5 years probation. And at the end of that, he actually said to the whole court that I never give probation for the type of, the type of offense, that's what I was looking for, that this young lady had hanging over her head. So, to this day, she's still continuing to work on her degree. Her children are she's just an aspiring young lady now and will actually be graduating from our program next month. She's been there, you know, her 3 years. And so we're just really proud of the work that we've done with her. And we have several stories like that, too. I won't go into all of them, but this is just an example of some of the things that the women in our program has actually experienced. And I just want to thank you for the time to listen.
Thank you for sharing your story. Are there any questions from members? Senator Lurie.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I guess I Amos Deinhardt asked if we had questions, and I do have one question just about the need statewide, because this comes at a time when on Friday DHS announced that they were actually closing a gender-specific CD treatment program in Carleton, in Carleton County, that is a what I believe is a really needed service for people. And it's a state-operated service, enterprise function, that's supposed to be self-supporting, and their main contention is that there isn't the client base to support it. And this just really troubles me, because I know I know these people. I know that these services are really needed, and it's kind of a similar vein that we're talking about here, and closure of this just really troubles me. So I'd like you to speak about the need for this type of a service statewide.
Well, Dr. Deinhardt.
We are limited in the number of folks we can serve, because the budget funds the facilitators. So if we had twice as many dollars, we'd have twice as many facilitators, and probably we could double our caseload. We're getting our referrals from drug court, from child protection directly, from various treatment centers. The OB service at Hennepin County Medical Center, the OB service at Fairview, so that we're finding moms just in Minneapolis, and we have to limit our draw because we transport our mothers to groups by taxi cab, and we have a fixed budget. We haven't had a raise in our budget, increase in our budget in 4 years, so but all of our costs go up. So we're somewhat limited, but I'm going to assume that Minneapolis is not unique in the kinds of problems that we're dealing with, that they're statewide, and there's nothing terribly magical about our approach. You know, the STEEP model is out there. It's nationally known, so lots of folks in other states are using the model. It's a matter of organizing and knowing how to apply it, and then, in theory, the program could be set up in other counties, and that was one of the things that we set out to do 2 years ago. One of the things that we'd like to do this year, if we maintain our funding, is to actually make an application for Rule 31 designation so that we can do the mental health chemical counseling in-house rather than having to rely on community resources. That's about a six to 12-month process to get approved, but we're going to start in the hopes that our funding will continue and we'll be able to add that additional service. But I share your concern. I think it exists around the state. The trick is, if you can't have a facility, how to use the community resources as best that they're available and marshal all of the forces to replicate what we're doing. Ours is clonable.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Lurie, the example that you bring up is exactly the reason that the governor's proposal to take $10 million out of chemical dependency rates over the next 2 years is troubling to me. I don't know if I'm the only one that feels like that's an awful lot of money to come out of this one service area, but and you know, that doesn't mean that there might not be room for, you know, trying to equalize the rates more, but when you take that much money out, you're going to see more things like you're describing to us this morning happening. And if we have fewer services available, it does seem to me that one can conclude that we will have fewer people receiving the services.
And yeah,
Dr. Deinhardt.
Part of your issue, I think, is that to have a child in foster care is it's an expensive proposition. And to be able to have that child with mother and faring well under the mother's watchful eye is the most sensible thing to do if it works out. Now, if you can, you know, there's always the downside. You can have a tragedy. But you can have a tragedy in a foster home, too. So, you know, the goal is to keep mothers and their children together and to help the mother stabilize so that she can do an effective and an enjoyable task of parenting.
Any further discussion?
Madam Chair,
Senator Lurie.
I appreciate the discussion. And actually, yeah, I mean, I asked the question. I know darn well that the need is out there, and so I appreciate the insights. And I just really have been troubled by the closing of these programs, and you know, in particular, the justification that they can't get the clients. The need is out there. It doesn't speak to a lowering of the need for people to get these services. It really speaks more to a poorly run program in my, you know, at the central office level, to my mind. If you're not out there finding the individuals who need these really cost-effective services, it doesn't speak to a lessening of the need in the community. It speaks to an inability to tap in and find that need and get people appropriately channeled to that service. And so I'm really troubled by this. It was just announced on Friday. The employees affected were notified before I was. We had that discussion last year in this body too, and I'm just really troubled by it and by the large amount of cuts in the CD programming as well. So I appreciate the opportunity to have some of these discussions. Thank you.
Senator Rosen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think the discussion, we could go on and on about this extremely important discussion, and we need to also include the aspect of prevention. And I liked your comments, Dr. Deinert, about what a program like this could be used out in Greater Minnesota.
Greater Minnesota,
should be,
yes,
duplicated. But I also just want to give an example of what my small community has done to work on the prevention side, especially with fetal alcohol syndrome. And of course, it took the initiative from the woman who runs the program in the city, and her husband's the chair of the Rotary Club. And they had two sessions, over 300 people signed up in two different sessions to learn about fetal alcohol syndrome, and it was all paid for by Rotary. So they used a private and the public sector to come together and do a training facility or a course for people that deal with, you know, educators, all across the board. There's, you know, nurses, practitioners, daycare providers. And it was very innovative that they didn't charge anything for the program. They just came in, they got their license, their some new information about chemical dependency and fetal alcohol syndrome. I thought that was very innovative for a small community.
Well, I think MOFAS is trying to do that around the state to educate women who are of childbearing age from high school on up about fetal alcohol syndrome and the downside.
Mm-hmm. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, we're hoping also that this bill will get passed before the end of the session. And so I would move that Senate file 694 as amended be recommended to pass.
On Senator Berglund's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Berglund.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next on the agenda, we'll go to Senate File 522, Senator Torres Ray. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, for the opportunity to bring before you Senate File 522, which is a bill about lead poisoning prevention. And some of you are familiar with this proposal that came before the policy committee. And basically what Senate File 522 intends to do is to reduce the elevated blood lead level from 10 micrograms of lead PD of blood to 5 micrograms. So it's simply a change in the level. And as members of this committee know, we have made significant progress in these areas. We understand the effect and toxicity of lead, and we have adopted significant changes. But over the past 40 years, we have discovered that blood lead concentrations, once believed to be safe, are actually toxic to children's developing brain and nervous system. There is growing scientific evidence published since 1991 that demonstrates the adverse effects among children whose blood lead concentration did not exceed the current exposure of 10 micrograms. And members, I have some experts that will be here to present the evidence. but there were some questions in the policy committee about the fiscal impact of this bill. And what I decided to do was to follow up on those requests and bring you that information, and I think staff had that has that available to you. And as a result of that, the House adopted an amendment to deal with that, because we know that these are difficult times and that it will be very difficult to ask the Department of Health to really move with the current program and to do the same kind of follow-up that they do on cases. And I have the E1 amendment, Madam Chair, that I would like to present, and I think that I apologize for, I know some of the staff is surprised about this, but this just happened in the House. So they did the fiscal note, and so I just got it about half an hour ago. So that's
Senator Torres-Ray, do you have a copy of the fiscal note for the amendment?
Madam Chair, I do not.
So I think what we'll do is we'll take a look at this, and then when we're done with our questions, we'll lay it over, because we really do need to have a fiscal note before we can proceed. But at least we've gotten this far. We only got this fiscal note at 6:30 last night, and so considering that you already have been working on a solution for your fiscal note only this morning, that's pretty good, I would say.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did my best to get you a fiscal note on this amendment, but I just couldn't get it this fast. So at this point, you have a fiscal note before you that is a preliminary note. And again, I want to make sure that I explain that this this group of kids that we're talking about will get the screening. I think there were some questions from members as to, you know, how much money it will take to screen a larger universe of children. And what you need to know is that, you know, all of these children are already tested. These universes that are determined by the department are tested. And through that screening process, we determine which children have, you know, different levels of lead in their blood. What we need to determine now is really to what extent we do a follow-up on a universe that will have a level between 5 and 10. Because all the children that are tested that are above 10, we already, you know, have the funding to follow up on that. And with me, Madam Chair, I have Mr. Yamin, who will be presenting some of the scientific evidence and responding to some of your questions.
Thank you, Senator. Madam Chair, Samuel Yamin, public health scientist with Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. And I did also bring some handout materials for the committee members. If I could ask the staff when it's convenient to get those out. I apologize, I didn't get a chance to talk to committee staff before the meeting started. As Senator Torres-Ray explained, Senate File 522 is a very straightforward piece of legislation. And as the senator described, it proposes to change the definition of children's elevated blood lead level from 10 micrograms of lead in 1 deciliter of blood to 5 micrograms of lead per deciliter. And the bill and amendment call for basic, cost-effective public health actions in those cases. The toxic effects of excessive lead exposure on the human brain and nervous system have been recognized for centuries. During the second half of the 20th century, it became increasingly evident that lower exposures to lead can also cause lasting impacts on intelligence and behavior, even when the dose is not immediately life-threatening. Higher exposures to lead have been identified as a risk factor for dropping out of high school, as well as for juvenile delinquency and criminal arrest, costly incidents. Over the past 40 years, great progress has been made in reducing the average lead exposure levels, yet the problem persists. The most widespread source of children's exposure today is lead paint, Lead was banned from paint production in 1978, but lead paint is still present in and around many older homes. Young children are at highest risk because they play and crawl in dust or soils containing lead paint particles, and they may put lead paint chips directly in their mouth. Additionally, children's brain and nervous system are undergoing rapid development, so the neurotoxic effects of lead can last throughout their lifetimes. Children's risk from lead is typically assessed by testing the concentration of lead in their blood, which in turn reflects their exposure to lead in the environment. Federal Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, and other public health agencies publish guidelines for blood lead testing and recommend public health actions to be taken at each exposure threshold. In most jurisdictions, but not all, the lowest of these regulatory thresholds is 10 micrograms of lead per deciliter of blood. That's the standard that we're here to discuss today. This concentration is the CDC level of concern, and it is also enforced in Minnesota as the elevated blood lead level. Beneath this level, no substantive public health actions are required or recommended even. However, CDC has acknowledged that current science demonstrates that this standard is not sufficiently protective. Over the past 40 years, science has repeatedly shown that blood lead concentrations, once believed to be safe, are actually toxic to children's developing brain and nervous system. In the 1960s, a concentration of 60 micrograms of lead per deciliter of blood was considered elevated. Since that time, the CDC has reduced its acceptable exposure limit or level of concern four times due to scientific evidence of harm. At each of these milestones, when the weight of scientific evidence showed that children's health and development are impacted at levels below the existing CDC benchmark, the agency responded by lowering that benchmark, making it more protective. In 1991, the last time the CDC did that, the agency adjusted the standard to 10 micrograms per deciliter. And CDC explained that they did that because 10 micrograms was the lower level of the range at which effects had been identified. That was at that time. Now we're 18 years later, and a large and growing body of scientific evidence demonstrates that intellectual and developmental effects occur among children whose blood lead concentrations do not exceed the existing limit. Studies published in recent years have shown that the exposure limit does not protect children from intellectual impairments. This can be quantified. This has been quantified as significant loss of points on IQ tests and other tests of brain function, cognitive ability, and normal psychological development, all impacted by levels below the existing limit. Researchers have also found a correlation between blood lead concentrations under 10 micrograms and lower reading and math scores on standardized tests that school systems administer to assess children's academic aptitude and academic performance. Similarly, in recent years, researchers have found that these levels of lead exposure are a risk factor for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, and the published estimates are that as many as 300,000 cases of ADHD nationwide are related to these levels of lead exposure. And this is a costly condition to families and the healthcare system. Published estimates on those costs are in the range of an average of $15,000 per year to families in the healthcare system. I will also briefly touch on a couple other economic points demonstrating that preventing these lead exposures is a good investment on the future of our society and our children and their reaching their potential. When millions of individuals' educational and workplace success is stunted, the cumulative economic impacts are enormous. Estimates published in the literature have placed the dollar figures on the lost productivity from today's contemporary blood lead exposures. At least $40 billion is drained from the U.S. economy due to lost productivity when children that are exposed, even at today's relatively lower blood lead exposure levels, become adults of working age. So a health protective lead exposure limit is a solid investment that will yield great economic returns. The indicators on the impacts are especially troubling, given that the majority of children exposed to lead paint today are already disadvantaged, mainly living in poverty-stricken areas of our cities. Not exclusively in the cities, but the problem is concentrated here in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And although our society has made great progress in reducing the occurrence of higher exposures, there are still hundreds of thousands of children nationwide who are exposed to these relatively lower levels of lead that now we know are hazardous. So not all children are faced with these health risks and obstacles to their success. African-American children are the hardest hit as a group, and children from lower-income families of any racial or ethnic background also face a disproportionately high risk. Senate File 522 would require simple, low-cost measures to be taken when a child's blood lead level exceeds 5 micrograms per deciliter. That would include thorough family education on steps that can be taken to reduce children's exposure to lead, and a recommendation for a follow-up blood test to make sure that the child's blood lead is not on the way up and to make sure that the simple actions that were taken are sending it back down so we can keep track of this and make sure that the child is not getting an exposure that really gets into the dangerous, impactful area. It also calls for a blood screening on other young children in the home. If you get one child that has a blood lead level that's a bit elevated, then it makes sense to look at other children under 5 years old, make sure that they are also not at a similar or greater risk. In terms of what the bill does not attempt to do, it does not attempt to change or supersede some of the higher regulatory thresholds already in place that require more intensive interventions, such as a home inspection or medical treatments, aside from just the blood screening. And I will just conclude by talking about another example of a lead-related standard that was recently changed due to scientific evidence that had accumulated during the intervening year since the last time it was updated. You may recall just a few months ago, back in 2008, the U.S. EPA revised its standard for lead particles in outdoor air. And the agency, again, cited advances in scientific knowledge of the health risk and made that air standard 10 times more protective. Similarly, a public health policy should be adjusted to reflect the fact that levels of lead in children's bodies that were once thought to be harmless have actually now been demonstrated to have a measurable negative impact on intelligence, behavior, and development. So the exposure limit for lead has been shown to be insufficiently protective of children's health, so that limit ought to be adjusted as it has been in the past. That concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Senator Torres-Ray, in looking over this amendment that you got from the House, we don't think that it's going to improve your situation, and so we're just going to set it aside. And Senate Counsel is going to be working with you on something else that may help. And so we won't be acting on this bill today. But we will take questions, and we're happy that we could have the testimony today. Are there any questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Torres-Ray, what is the federal level for lead?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, right now is 10.
It is 10.
Senator Rosen, one issue that has become pretty obvious in Minnesota is that we have a number of low-income children, predominantly low-income children, that live in certain areas of the state of Minnesota who have a level of 5 and 10. And as you heard from the testimony, what we know is that we, through scientific evidence, we know more and more that there is a correlation between the level of blood and the IQ points and how these ADHD and other issues that are affecting this group of children. And what we are attempting to do with this is to begin to do some testing with young children. The amendment is clear about under five, because the impact on brain development is something that we are knowing more about it. So we want to make sure that we expand this testing to level five, between 5 and 10. So that's the intent behind this legislation, to really begin to understand how this lower level affect the developing brain of young children.
Any other questions? Okay, then we'll just set this bill aside and come back to it another day, maybe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Senator Murphy, Senate File 97. Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, Senate File 97 is the medicinal marijuana bill. It's been through several committees before. A lot of people on this committee have heard it in one committee or another, either this year or last year. So I think the guts of the bill are pretty much the same. But we're looking at a fiscal note now. And I just want to point out to members a couple things that could improve the fiscal note. One, they use the assumption that Minnesota is like Oregon in regards to medicinal marijuana, and there is the Colorado experience, which would more accurately reflect what's going on in Minnesota. Not only is their law more closely aligned to what we're proposing to do here, but their population is about the same as Minnesota. It's Oregon is, they're bigger than Minnesota substantially. The other thing that's in the fiscal note on page 3 of 15, you'll notice down at the bottom, the second bullet point, it talks about the registered organizations, and they assume that the fee is $500 there. The fee is actually $1,000 in the bill. So there's a discrepancy in the fiscal note in that regard as well. Members, I do have an amendment that I would like to put on the bill in regards to the fiscal implications, which basically raises up all of the costs for the registrations.
Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
Is this A3, is that the amendment Senator Murphy's referring to?
Right, he's increasing the fees in the bill, which would increase.
Madam Chair, I would so move the A3 amendment to Senator Murphy's bill.
Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor of the amendment say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. Mm-hmm.
And members, one other thing that I believe that would make the fiscal note more accurate is they also talk about cards reissued due to loss or content changes. And they say that 70% of the cards are either going to be lost or there's going to be some change in a person's status on the card. And I think that's a little bit high. I don't know what the experience is in, say, the state of Colorado or another state that actually asked for these cards to be used. But I doubt it's as high as 70%. But anyway, the amendment speaks to the issue of the fiscal note, and I think that if you combine, a couple of things that could improve the fiscal note and then the amendment, Madam Chair, I think that we're getting pretty close to having, at least in the out year, something that actually generates revenue. or it will generate revenue. Even under the fiscal note, the way that it's written, it shows that in the out years it generates revenue.
So the way the fiscal note works here is in the first 2 years, the program would be financed out of the special revenue fund, and then the fees would begin generating revenue, and then the fees would pay the fund back. Mm-hmm. And I think Senator Murphy's point is that at least in fiscal year 13, it would generate more money than it is using out of the special revenue fund.
Right, Madam Chair. And if it would make the committee more comfortable, we could also put a rider on there that would say that these funds stay, or these whatever generates stays in the fund until the fund has been, you know, pay back, because the first year we're going to need a little money in that fund to, you know, get the program running. So
that happens automatically.
Oh, okay.
When we oftentimes when we license a new profession, mm-hmm. They don't generate the revenue, but well, they generate the revenue over time, but we need to have the activity in place right away. So this is not unusual. We look for balance over a 4-year period is what we do. Are there any questions about the fiscal note? We will need to get a new fiscal note, but this is special revenue, and the amendment should cause the fiscal note to become, to generate increasing funds. So I don't think we need to lay the bill over. We can just have that new fiscal note for the full finance committee. Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Murphy, this is the first time I have seen this bill this year. I do not sit on the policy committee for Health and Human Services, and I was wondering if you could direct me where in the bill we have a quality control measure as far as what type of marijuana that is being grown, how it's being. I'm an agronomist, so I could get into the lingo here, but basically I'm very concerned about the parameters of the product that's coming out, and if there is any guidelines and stops as far as who's growing it, how it's grown, what type of herbicides, pesticides, mm-hmm. whatever, is being used on this product.
Madam Chair, there is, and Senator Rosen, there's a 12-plant limit for those who wish to grow. Now, we've heard testimony saying that, you know, this is going to allow the proliferation of mass quantities of marijuana to be grown and dispensed in the state. We heard testimony that a plant would generate, you know, untold pounds of marijuana. But under the federal program, because the feds have a program for medicinal marijuana, they say that one plant produces 0.22 pounds of usable marijuana. So it's far lower than the amount that some people believe that a plant produces. As far as the growing of marijuana, I believe that that is, that's the limit. It's 12 plants. You know, you can, under this bill, we changed it so you could grow your own, because there are people who may want to use this that live, say, in Bowabic, and maybe 50 to 100 miles from the closest place dispensary. And, you know, and being in agriculture, you know that every plant that's out there has a different growing cycle. And so if you have 12 plants, you might have three that are mature and, you know, a couple three that are in the eight-month stage, and you catch my drift. They're, each plant is not harvestable 100% of the time. I mean, so that's why there's so many plants. When you're talking about herbicides and pesticides. You know, these are going to be grown inside in locked facilities. That's one of the requirements of the bill. So you shouldn't need herbicide or pesticide. You might want to use Miracle-Gro. I know that everybody that grows, you know, flowers or anything inside on a regular basis every now and again throws a little Miracle-Gro in there to help out. Other than that, Senator, I think that's
Madam Chair.
About it.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But Senator Murphy, you didn't really get to my question, and that mm-hmm. deals with the quality control measure of something like this.
Mm-hmm.
Do you apply for a license to grow these to be able to sell them to the practitioners or the primary caregivers? And who is controlling the quality of this plant? I mean, you may want to laugh at that, but that you can do some serious. This is basically you're using a plant as a medicinal painkiller.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's a lot of room for tampering within that,
and
so I'm very concerned that.
Mm-hmm.
So step me through. Is there quality measures in this product? I don't care about the time growth and all that, and but there is room for tampering, Senator Murphy.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I don't understand what you're getting at. There has been, since this state was formed, there has been zero deaths from abuse of marijuana, and that's an illegal form. Since this country has been formed, there has been zero deaths because of the abuse of marijuana. Madam Chair and Senator, I'm not going to say it's impossible to grow anything that would to grow marijuana that would be so potent that it would cause death, but I think that the people, other states, the experience in other states would dictate that that's not the case. There's been zero deaths because of medicinal marijuana. In the same time, there's been over 11,000 deaths in the nation because of abuse of things like OxyContin. Now, I think that if we're going to use something to help, you know, take the edge off of pain for the people who can get it under this bill, marijuana is the right way to go. I mean, it curbs, it takes the edge off the pain for some people. I mean, it's just like other drugs. It doesn't have 100% effective use all the time, just like OxyContin and a lot of other things that actually will kill you.
Madam Chair, I'm still
Senator
not getting.
Rosen?
I'm sorry, Senator Murphy. I'm still not getting my point across, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
It, perhaps you can explain who is supplying the marijuana besides the person who can grow it for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Their own use.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, page 11 explains what the registered organizations are, and those are nonprofit entities registered with the commissioner, and that's Commissioner of Health, because this is a health issue, and it describes the parameters by which they play the game. The other thing that's very important to note in, you know, when it in regards to the hanky-panky that people think are going to happen, here's what the Department of, let's see, this is Sentencing Guideline Commission. This is what they say. It assumes that most marijuana sellers will seek their marijuana elsewhere since the amount obtainable at any one time is so small, talking about the bill. Therefore, it assumes that few offenders will be sentenced for this new offense, and almost all who are will not receive prison sentences. You know, there's some other there was some other accusations that have been made in this regard by other people in law enforcement, and this comes out of the Corrections Department, and they just basically say that most people procuring controlled substances by fraud are seeking synthetic narcotics. That's not medicinal marijuana, because marijuana is easier to obtain without fraud. It's estimated the number of persons sentenced for this new felony will be small. Now, I realize you're talking about the kind of the chain of custody of the product. When you talk about Okay, there's two things you're talking about here. One is chain of custody. I think that's spelled out very clearly in the bill, what the registered organization can do, what the user of the product can do and can't do. And by the way, I mean, you know, right now if you had 2 ounces of pot and you're walking down the street, you'd basically get a traffic ticket. Under this bill, it's a felony. And, you know, I think they wrote a song about that. It's called Going to Jail. So I don't think people are going to, you know, go through the, you know, much like the gun debate, I don't think a lot of people are going to go through the time of getting the card and the expense of getting the card and then somehow become a menace to society. We've got 13 other states, and there are no menaces in society that are doing this currently. There's 13 other states. So I think the Chicken Little crowd that's crying that the sky's going to fall is a little overkill. I mean, we had the same experience with the concealed carry gun bill. You know, the first year I was one of those Chicken Littles running around saying, you know, there's going to be gunfights on the street and this, that, and the other. And Senator Coring remembers I wore this bulletproof vest on the Senate floor. And, yeah, I got in a little bit of trouble for that. So. But anyway, it didn't come. It didn't make any difference. It just didn't make any difference, one way or the other. I mean, it didn't protect people's lives more securely, and it sure didn't start gunfights out on Main Street. So, I think a lot of the Chicken Little crowd is, well, it's Chicken Little, in my opinion. I don't know what else I can say, Senator. But you know, the bill is tightly crafted. We had hoped to work with law enforcement. Unfortunately, they just want to come to the table and say they're against the bill and then start spouting off reasons as to why they're against the bill that, you know, quite frankly, aren't true.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Murphy. I think what might help in this discussion is could you talk about how the other 13 states that have passed this have come to terms with the fact that you might not be able to monitor when you're purchasing that small amount what the potency is of the substance that you're buying, that unlike a pill that you buy at the drug counter, you know what the dosage is, but you may not know that when you're purchasing marijuana, even though it's grown within these systems.
Right.
And we haven't yet got the in this language, and certainly people will have to experiment in a sense about what, how much they need to inhale in order to be able to have the impact that they want. But the other states apparently have come to terms with that in some way.
Madam Chair, I'll have Ms. Saucy take that question if that's all right.
Welcome to our committee. You want to identify yourself?
Yes, my name is Heather Otsi. I represent Minnesotans for Compassionate Care. The other 13 states have very different models. Only two at this point have a dispensing system of any kind. Every patient in these other states or their caregiver cultivates marijuana for that patient's use. So there really isn't any quality control measure in any of the other states at all. California is one of the only states that has a dispensing model. And in California, the law was passed by a ballot initiative. It was only a couple of sentences long. The state has no ability to regulate because California, you cannot amend or repeal, create any law that will amend or appeal the ballot initiative passed by the voters. So there is no quality control measures in California. New Mexico is another state. They're just setting up a dispensing system now. And the regulatory agencies down there are working on some kind of a quality control mechanism.
Senator
and
Lori.
Madam Chairman.
On that issue, I mean, maybe we could get at, I think it is, so have patients been okay at just finding their dosage? It would kind of be the what we're trying to get at here, I think. I mean,
absolutely.
So there isn't, we don't measure the amount of THC or potency of it, but do patients in these other 13 states have a pretty good time of I guess pretty good time might not be the right way to phrase it, but do they do all right experimenting and finding the dose that works well for them and knowing their sources?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members, they do. When medical marijuana is consumed, a patient feels the effect almost immediately and has a very strong ability to titrate their dose. They have no issue.
Mm-hmm. And, Madam Chair, once again,
Senator Murphy.
Some of the testimony that we had in committee, one person was a doctor from the state of Michigan. Actually, he started his practice here in Minnesota. But he moved to Michigan, and his wife got sick and was dying from cancer. And she was trying to take Marinol, which is a synthetic form of THC. And it was making her sick. It was actually making her hallucinate. She decided to quit taking it when she saw a severed head setting out in the backyard. That's how powerful that drug is. So the doctor was, you know, and this is a gentleman at the time, I believe he must have been in his 60s. He's in his 70s now. But he was talking to some of his friends and just said, you know, there's no relief for my wife. And he was just broken up about it, as we all would be. And, you know, he was wanting to try some marijuana. Well, some showed up on his front step one day. And he said, it took my wife two breaths of marijuana smoke, and her pain was gone, and she was able to eat lunch. And he said, lunch is not a big deal unless you can't eat it. And, you know, he said that was the first time that she'd taken lunch for months. But two breaths. So, Senator Laurie, you're right. It's kind of a self-regulating thing. And once again, there's no reported cases in the history of the world of anybody ODing on marijuana and dying. I mean, zero. And meanwhile, we're asking some of these families to deal with their sick and sometimes dying by using these narcotics that, and I think everybody in here has seen this, that just make the patient they're not with you. I mean, we all know it. They got the glassy eyes, and they're sitting there, and they're half awake and half asleep. You know, it's like my dad. He didn't know what planet he was on the last few days. You know, and I know that end-of-life issues, people want to be able to at least, you know, say their goodbyes and be around their families. And you know, if we use heavy narcotics, they're not able to do that. With medicinal marijuana, there's good research to show that two things happen. One, sometimes they get relief, like the doctor's wife, and was able to kind of carry on without being so heavily sedated that she couldn't interact with her family. The other thing that it showed is that by using, for some people, by using a little bit of both, you know, it enhanced the effect of the, you know, whatever the narcotic prescription might be, along with the medicinal marijuana, seem to, you know, kind of that spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down easier. So it kind of made it easier on them to take this medicine. So, you know, there's a lot of, I suppose, anecdotal stories out there that we've heard in committee, but they're real life stories. And everybody in here has been impacted one way or another within a life issue. So,
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Murphy. And I guess first I'd just say I'm sorry I wasn't there in Judiciary when you brought this bill here. Because
I am too.
I had a speaking engagement that I had a commitment to, because, and I say that because there are a couple of things here. I hope you'll have a willingness to have a discussion with me that I won't go into here, because I mm-hmm. think they're quite a bit beyond the parameters of this committee. So I'm just going to stick to a couple of observations related to what's already been discussed here. On lines 2.6 and 2.7, it talks about the number of marijuana plants that is allowed for a registered organization. And basically it says 12 marijuana plants per patient and any amount of other parts of the marijuana plant. And I would just say that that's kind of contradictory from a grammatical sense. I mean, if you're a plant, how can you be an other part of the plant? I mean, one is sort of incorporated within the other, and I would say from a legal standpoint, or, you know, that almost makes it impossible to enforce a law because it's not clear, the law with respect to any amount of marijuana, because so I would just point out that that's almost an open-ended blanket to any amount of marijuana being legal. And in terms of the quantity, you know, from what I remember of the testimony a couple years ago when you had this bill, I think law enforcement said that marijuana is, I don't remember if any, if you can quantify this exactly, 20 times stronger than it used to be when we were, say, back in our college days. Maybe it was even more than that. But 2.5 ounces, I think, is, you know, we're talking about the little bags of marijuana that I remember seeing, and I'll just say, honestly, I've seen those little bags of marijuana. I think they held about an ounce.
Who in here hasn't seen it? Raise your hand. Oh, wait a minute. I can't do that.
So, you know, if we're talking about a product that's about 20 times stronger and 2.5 ounces plus the plants, mm-hmm. we aren't talking about an insignificant amount of a drug that has a pretty high level of the ability to have an impact. And I understand, Senator Murphy, that what you're saying about no one ever ODs on marijuana, but I have to say that that, in a sense, I think kind of trivializes to a degree the level of what is a problem. I guess it, because I would have to say, thinking about people I went to high school with, that there are at least several of them who are dead now that I would attribute to marijuana use, because it's not an immediate ODing kind of thing. It's more of a longer-term chronic impact over time related to that use. And I've been in presentations that have talked a lot about the impact of marijuana on a person's not only physiological but mental health, birth defects. I mean, I don't think it would be responsible not to treat it like we're talking about a serious drug. So I'm concerned about it from that standpoint, but also from the standpoint of what law enforcement says this is going to do. So anyway, I guess I mainly wanted to point out that one provision, and then in terms of the discussion about quantity and quality control, I mean, we have an FDA that controls even aspirin. There's not really anything in here, and I think that was what Senator Rosen was getting at, that would look at a fairly powerful drug in a fairly substantial amount and make sure that it is delivered as safely as possible to those situations that you've used as illustrations, where I think we all have a lot of compassion and understanding for people in the, but that's not the only situation that would come into play here. And then I had one final question for you. You have a one of the categories, and from lines 2.9 on down to 2.20, you know, the word there is used as or. So we're not just talking about having to be people with, if they can meet any one of those categories, they're going to be authorized. Mm-hmm. So if a person has... intractable pain, for example, then they're going to be authorized. If a person has cancer at any stage, and I'm not sure if that would include in remission or what, they're going to be authorized. I mean, there's a lot of very broad definitions there. I don't have in here the definition of intractable pain, but it references another statute.
Right.
Do you know what that definition is, or do we have that available?
Yeah, that's in 152.251, I believe.
Or 125, it says
125,
here.
125, right. And it it outlines what intractable pain is, and this is absolutely the highest measure of the issue of pain of any of the 13 states that have this on the law. The other states are either silent on it or they have a lower standard. Ours is defined by statute. I mean, it's in the statute. You can take a gander at it, but it's...
Senator Murphy, you don't know or you don't happen to have that?
I don't have a copy in front of me, but there's a bunch of red books over there. And
And then, Madam Chair, Senator Murphy, the one other comment that I was going to make is something, again, I'll just stick to something you've already discussed and referenced. You said that, you know, there was an assumption when the fiscal note was done that there wouldn't be fraud, wouldn't be used, because, like for OxyContin.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, because we don't have medical marijuana right now, people who are going to obtain marijuana aren't going to do it through fraud, because the prescription is what gives a person the right to get OxyContin. So you're really not comparing apples to apples, because unless and until we pass this law, it really isn't, fraud doesn't really come into play, because it would only come into play if we passed this law, and then a prescription would be more similar to an OxyContin situation, where the right to have a card or the right to a prescription would give you a right to a quantity of marijuana. So I guess I was just pointing out that I was interpreting that fiscal note differently, or the comments to the fiscal note, I guess, differently than you did. So.
Okay, well, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, you bring up a couple things, but intractable pain means a pain state in which the cause of pain cannot be removed or otherwise treated with the consent of the patient, and in which the generally accepted course of medical practice, no relief or cure for the cause of pain is possible, or none has been found after reasonable efforts. And then it goes on to talk about reasonable efforts. I mean, it's absolutely the highest standard of any of the 13 states, Senator Olson. You also mentioned a couple other things. You know, you keep saying that law enforcement keeps saying that this stuff's 20 times stronger. There's no evidence to that, Madam Chair. There's none whatsoever. And people are talking about this, as you did, Senator Olson, as an illegal act. We're trying to make what some people are doing today legal, because it should be legal. And I think that's the difference between the way that you and I look at it. You also mentioned FDA. Well, they've done a bang-up job, Madam Chairman. Can I go down and start listing drugs like Vioxx? And, you know, they approved that drug, and it killed over 1,000 people in 1 year. So I don't know if the FDA is probably the place that we want to take medicinal marijuana.
Senator Olson.
Besides that, Madam Chair, if I might, on the issue of the FDA, they won't even look at it, okay?
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Murphy. And I understand the federal law doesn't allow them to have jurisdiction over this, and that's been part of the problem, because, mm-hmm. you know, I think there are those of us whose concern is not so much the person who comes to testify here who fits a situation where they're in a chronic or end-of-life situation,
mm-hmm.
and really is the kind of person you're describing. I think the concern is that this is going to become an inability or a much more difficult time for law enforcement to enforce the law with respect to non-serious medical situations. And again, without belaboring the point, my position on your bill is that it's way too broad, and it allows way too much room for that kind of abuse. And it is a much broader law than we had, than we ended up with 2 years ago, in terms of the amount, the quantity of marijuana that people would be able to have in their possession,
mm-hmm.
as well as some of the other restrictions and narrowing of the bill that we did 2 years ago that was passed on the floor.
Mm-hmm. And Madam Chairman and Senator Olson, in that regard, you know, Montana had an experience where their allowable possession was an ounce. And they're going to change that, or an ounce and a half, I believe, and they're going to change that to three. And law enforcement supports that, by the way, in the state of Montana, because their state's big and, you know, geographically, much like Minnesota. And, you know, people in outlying areas are, just don't have access to the, you know, to the registry or well, to the registry, or they don't grow their own. So when they have to drive to get it, you know, they're driving a long way. So they're changing their law so that they can pick up three instead of one. And, Madam Chair, I think, and Senator Olson, I think that that's probably the reason why we want this to stay at 2.5, because, like I said earlier, you know, there's people in, you know, Bowabic that may have to drive 50 or 100 miles, and I don't think that you want either the cancer patient or a family member of theirs having to make a trip every week or 2 weeks. So it's more
Senator
for a
Olson,
matter of
I would
of,
just say that, you know, the fraudulent use of the prescriptions in this bill don't bother me. I just don't think it'll be a problem as long as there are half a dozen convenience stores and gas stations that sell this under the counter. I mean, why would somebody want to go to the trouble of trying to fraudulently get a prescription if they can
get it easier?
If they can get it more conveniently through other means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Madam Chair, and you bring up a good point, too. I don't think that any doctor in the state of Minnesota is going to risk their reputation or their license by issuing, a written note to an individual that doesn't qualify under what the bill is. I just, you know, we forget that fact, that the doctor has to say that, Senator Olson, I believe that you have intractable pain or, you know, you've got cancer or, you know, Crohn's disease or whatever, and I think that this might help you. It's still your choice. I mean, you would probably say no. Somebody else might say yes. I think that that's the choice that we should leave to doctors and patients, much like the choices that we leave to doctors and patients when the doctor may be prescribing a therapy for, you know, a bum knee or something.
We do want to make sure we hear from the opposition, and we have a couple more questions here. So why don't we hold the questions, because you might have more questions after you hear the rest of the testimony. And why don't we take testimony from those who are opposed to the bill. Is there anybody that wanted to testify? Identify yourself for the record.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council, and we oppose the bill for a number of reasons, and a number of them have already been brought up. We just think we have to weigh, though, the health risks to the community and society, which we feel will result from this passage of this bill. Obviously, there are situations where people feel that this is going to help them in their distress, but it was brought up, for instance, in Colorado, which would be comparable to Minnesota. There are about 5,000 people using marijuana for medical purposes, and we just think that there's a lot of potential for abuse in terms of the amount that can be grown. 12 plants, I've talked to people who have actually grown marijuana, and they say that that can produce upwards of 35,000 marijuana cigarettes or joints a year. And you're going to allow 18-year-olds to be growing this. You could literally have hundreds, even conceivably thousands of people growing marijuana across the state. And I think that's just going to make it more difficult to regulate and control and confine how it's produced and where it's going to be disseminated. And this is a dangerous drug. People say, well, we've got alcohol, but I don't know that legalizing marijuana is going to address the problems we have with alcohol, but we think this is only going to make a bad situation worse. For instance, England has reclassified their drug, marijuana. They reduced the penalty criminally, but then they increased it because they saw all the problems resulting from it. So we just have concerns that this sends a wrong message to our young people. When you have marijuana, which is a dangerous drug, addictive, a gateway drug, now being treated as medicine, it's just going to send conflicting signals to our young people. So I think you have to look at the whole picture. It's not just those few people who obviously have gone through pain. And I can commiserate. I mean, I went through cancer myself this past year, and I know the pain involved, but I'm just concerned that you have to look at the big picture and how this is going to impact the broader community. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Yeah.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you happen to know anything about the current recommendations coming from the sentencing guidelines as far as, no? Okay.
No.
I'll save my question.
Okay, thank you very much. Anyone else who wanted to testify against the bill? Okay, then Senator Murphy, why don't we take the remaining questions? Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I have comments, not questions. And I would like to remind people, this is an end-of-life issue. I agree, it's gateway drug. But we're not talking about a gateway at end-of-life. We're talking about quality of life, and why are we so afraid to eliminate or to reduce people's pain in their final days? I think every year I come back to my practice, and I sit on the oncology team, and my doctors say, have you passed that marijuana bill yet? What's holding it up? They have patients that can't afford their medications. Marinol costs $1,000. And it doesn't work anyways. It doesn't work the way that the marijuana does. It's easy. It's a simple solution. It can be controlled. It can be managed. And it provides the type of relief without taking away all the sensibilities of the patient while it's being administered and allows them to have a quality of life at the end of life. It seems like a simple solution. It's been tried in other areas, and it works.
Okay, Senator Rosen.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Murphy, you're doing pretty good until you mentioned that marijuana should be legal because they're doing it anyway. They're smoking pot anyway. So we should make it legal. You made that comment, Senator Murphy, and my first thought in my mind was, well, prostitution. Let's make prostitution legal because they're doing it anyway. But it's very hard to make that comment right after Senator Prettner-Solon's passionate plea about patients that obviously would like this as an alternative. I do see some serious flaws in the bill still, and one of them that I think some of the senators probably articulated better than I could is on the quality control measure of it, the tampering issue, and I think that's a real issue. So I'm still very concerned about that. Where is their guidelines? Where is their enforcement in the quality of the product that's coming out? Mm-hmm. And that, I think, should be looked at. But my question, Madam Chair and Senator Murphy, is on page 11, line 21, the registration with the Commissioner of Commissioner of Health, I would assume.
Mm-hmm.
And this registered organization, do you have guidelines? Do you have examples of what some of the other states have done, how they have registered this product, and what the people that will be cultivating it, growing it, and selling it, what they're responsible for? Because this is ripe for tampering, I mean, this whole arena. And I could see a completely different sideline market if we don't mm-hmm. be careful. A sideline market and also on the quality. I mean, seriously, you get somebody that's deranged, they could. That's why we have the little seal on our aspirin now, because of some tampering. So this, if you're going down that direction as a medicinal drug, we should take some quality measures.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, first, when I said they're doing it anyway, I was talking about these patients who choose to use marijuana to help relieve some of their pain. That's who I was talking about. You're talking about the war on drugs. I don't know. Just personal opinion. You know, war on drugs. I just, this country has spent trillions of dollars on the war on drugs, Senator. And it's more prevalent today than it ever has been. Now, we're talking about this bill, given those people who are at end-of-life issues, people who are in intractable pain, and several other diseases, the ability to use marijuana legally so that they don't have to be outside of the bounds of the law. Now, and for the rest of your comments, I think I'll let Ms. Ossie talk about what the experience is in other states.
Madam Chair, members, like I said before, in the other states, most of the patients cultivate their own medication or designate a caregiver to cultivate it for them. This registered organization system that is regulated as tightly as it is in this bill is new.
Madam
so
Chair, Ms. Ossie?
Anybody that's worried about quality control could be growing their own, and then they don't have to worry about tampering or dosage or whatever. Mm-hmm.
And Madam Chairman and Senator, you mentioned the little seal on the cap of, I don't know, whatever you buy at the drugstore anymore. I don't know. That dude that was killing people in the Tylenol scare, those all had that little cap. I mean.
Madam Chair. Senator Murphy, you still didn't get to my question about the Department of Health's issue with this, and they're registering with the registration with the department, and mm-hmm. and also, I mean, there's quite a bit in here about this buying it from a registered organization. So mm-hmm. first, there's a lot in the registered organization. So if you're sick, do you need to go ahead and register with the commissioner to grow it yourself? Or are you going to be buying it from somebody that's growing it as a profit? And where is the Department of Health in there? And
Senator Murphy.
Madam Chair and Senator, this is a health issue, so the Department of Health is in charge, obviously. Now, everybody that's going to use the product has to go to the Department of Health. I mean, you know, you have to have the recommendation from your doctor first, you know, so that's kind of the first gate is that, you know, your doctor has to say that, you know, you need this. You get your card. It's going to cost you. You know, you got to have a photo on it. You got to have your name, address, all the good stuff. And you got a card. And the only thing that card allows you to do is to go to the registered organization and either buy or you could grow your own. If you sign up with a registered organization, they can grow up to 12 plants on your behalf. Now, these are nonprofit agencies. It says so right on 1121. It means a nonprofit entity registered with the commissioner under this section. And it's regulated. I mean, I don't know.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, I'm going to take another line then, because I'm not feeling like I'm getting my point across or that you're understanding my question.
Madam Chair, I understand your question perfectly, Senator Rosen,
Senator
but there is no way
Murphy,
to answer it.
If we can go through the chair.
I'm sorry, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Senator Murphy.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rosen, I don't know how you answer the question of content, THC content, of the product without testing every plant that's grown. Now, I don't think that is a responsible thing for us to do. One, the cost would be astronomical. Two, you don't need to because, once again, this is not one of those heavy narcotics that kills people.
Okay.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, a registered organization, Senator Murphy, that has to go through the Department of Health. Are there guidelines from the department about who can qualify to be a registered organization? Okay. If that's a yes, my next question, Madam Chair, would be on the felonies. Now, what is the felony if they are caught in possession with some marijuana?
Mm-hmm.
What is the current felony in law, and what is the felony in your – are they the same?
No, Madam Chairman, right now if you were busted for, you know, and you had 2 ounces of pot, it's not a felony.
It's a misdemeanor.
But if you're jacking around with this law and you're one of the registered organizations or an individual, and you decide to sell 2 ounces to somebody, then it's a felony. And it's very clear in the bill under both of the under all three places where it talks about, you know, what are the fines for going outside the parameters of the bill. The Department of Health didn't help us write this bill, Madam Chair and Senator, so I don't understand your question about what are they doing. They're not doing anything until we direct them to do something. So,
any other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Murphy. One other thing, I'm going to try to just point out a couple of things that I think are more related to the health aspect of this than the law enforcement concerns that I have. But on page 5, on lines 5.12, where you're talking about the practitioner not being able to be in any way basically impacted for distributing this drug, I guess I would just say that, once again, this is a much broader standard than we have in terms of how we regulate other drugs or people who dispense other drugs. I mean, right now, if you had a doctor, or this also applies to nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, osteopaths, who were dispensing, for example, OxyContin, and you looked and you saw that they've written a very large disproportionate number of those prescriptions in relation to the patients they see, mm-hmm. they would be subject to, you know, perhaps some action on by their board, or, you know, there's some oversight on things like that. Mm-hmm. This basically says they can't be impacted in any way. They can't have any manner or deny any right privilege, including discipline actually by the Board of Medical Practice, so forth, licensing boards, solely for providing written certifications or otherwise. So they could be writing 100,000 of these, and we wouldn't be able to do anything to them the way I'm reading this. I also see when you have the report to the legislature about, you know, the number of these things that are being written, and it does, you have non-identifiable information that would be provided to the legislature in a report. And the way I'm reading that, again, there's nothing that would give us the ability to see if there are some practitioners that are writing an inordinate number of these. Mm-hmm. So once again, to the extent you take, you know, any suggestions from someone who you know isn't really on the same page with you about this, I would at least say if we could tie the number of those prescriptions being written to a particular practitioner, even if it's non-identifiable, it would help to point out a problem. And I do think that this paragraph should be changed to allow some ability to look at people who are perhaps setting up business as a nurse practitioner and doing nothing but just dispensing these prescriptions, because I do think that could be very profitable for someone and something we would want to control.
Senator Olson, I just have to mention the irony of your comments, because a few years ago we did pass legislation to allow us to claim federal funding to set up a tracking system for prescriptions that are issued in regard to OxyContin and other like drugs. But the legislation specifically exempts any action to be taken against a physician at the request of the Board of Medical Examiners. So the system will be able to be used to try to find people on the street selling these drugs illegally. It will be a system that can be used by law enforcement. It will be a system that can be used by physicians to track if someone's gotten another prescription that week or that day from another physician. But it specifically cannot be used to track physicians in terms of the number of prescriptions that they might be writing to patients in general.
And
Senator Murphy.
And Madam Chair, thank you for that. Also, Senator, if you start on line 516 and go down through 520, you know, the Board of Medical Practice can still sanction practitioners if they go outside of the bounds of what they feel is appropriate. And that's right there, providing nothing shall prevent a practitioner from being sanctioned for failure to properly evaluate a patient's medical condition. So if the board feels that the practitioner did not, you know, if they feel that the individual is going outside of what is written here in this bill, I'm sure that there's going to be a sanction, because the medical profession, I mean, they don't want, you know, they don't want scars on their record. It's just like any other profession that's out there.
Senator Coyne.
Madam Chair, I would so move that Senate File 97, as amended, be recommended to pass.
Any further questions? Any further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rose.
Where does this bill go from here, may I ask?
The full Finance Committee.
Madam Chair and Senator Murphy, will this bill go to public safety?
Madam Chair, I don't believe so. I think it goes to Finance and then the floor.
Judiciary.
It's been to Judiciary, Madam Chair and Senator Rosen.
The fiscal notes would not indicate that it would need to go to another division within the Finance Committee. I mean, unless a chair asks for it for some reason.
Mm-hmm. Well, Madam Chair, I know this bill came to public safety last time. I believe it was last year. I believe it came through 2 years
ago. Well, you might want to speak with Senator Higgins about that. Senator Cohen can re-refer it within the divisions, but our motion would be for it to go to full finance, and then they do what they're going to do with it.
Because, Madam Chair, I believe there is quite a few areas that I have not jumped into because I've been trying to keep it in the realm of the fiscal note and MDH, but there are some issues with the sentencing, the felony charges, the sentencing guidelines, just the whole message coming from law enforcement that I would hope that we'd have that opportunity, Senator Murphy, to talk about instead of on the floor.
Well, if you want to, you can talk with Senator Cohen and Senator Higgins if you feel it should be re-referred to another division. Any further discussion of the motion before us? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion does prevail.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members.
And with that, the meeting is adjourned.